bottom line here is we have the first judge in the country who's facing the question of what do you do when you have a president-elect who's a convicted felon? And the question is, we have a conviction, and what do we do about this?
Excellent question. Maybe we'll get some answers today.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Why?
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From the Pacifica Radio Network in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also on other fine terrestrial affiliate stations around the country in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, at least for now, as well as coast to coast and around the globe on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. As I said, for now, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. New York prosecutors on Tuesday told the judge who presided over Donald Trump's hush money trial and 34 felony fraud convictions by a jury of his peers that they agree that sentencing of the once and future president should be postponed for now, while Donald Trump's lawyers file further legal arguments seeking a complete dismissal of the charges related to his payoff to porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election that helped him cheat to win that election. Prosecutors in Manhattan, DA Alvin Bragg's office, however, said that they would challenge Trump's efforts to dismiss the case entirely. But they agreed that we are all in uncharted territory when it comes to sentencing a former president who has reportedly been elected to become president again, and acknowledge that his sentencing might need to take place after his next term in office. On Wednesday, in response, in a letter to trial judge Juan Merchan, Trump demanded that his conviction be immediately thrown out entirely, arguing that if sentencing previously scheduled for November 26 moves forward in any way, shape, or form ever, that it would be, quote, uniquely destabilizing to the country, unquote. As they write in the just released letter, quote, immediate dismissal of this case is mandated by the federal constitution, the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, and the interests of justice in order to facilitate the orderly transition of executive power following President Trump's overwhelming victory in the 2024 presidential election. Now, I'm not sure, Desi Doyen, that losing the popular vote and defeating his main opponent by just over 1.5 percentage points is actually an overwhelming victory.
Well, it certainly isn't, but they're going to claim it is.
They already are, and they'll continue to do so as long as we let them. Again, he lost the popular vote to the majority of voters who voted against him. In any case, I will wait for them also to show us where either the Presidential Transition Act, which Trump, as we discussed in great detail earlier this week, is already, Trump is already openly violating that Transition Act himself. Also, I'll wait for them to show us where the U.S. Constitution mandates that a person elected president must have all of their criminal convictions just tossed out. But Trump's attorneys also cite so-called presidential immunity as a reason to dismiss the case, maintaining that Trump is already protected by it, even for crimes that he committed before becoming president back in 2016. In the meantime, former federal prosecutor Randall Eliason, who served as the Department of Justice's chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption section in D.C., is now calling for New York Justice Juan Merchan to sentence Trump right now, or at least before he is sworn into office again on January 20. We will talk to him about that momentarily and what that would mean for a potential and or other type of sentence. I'm looking forward to that conversation. Also today, the U.S. House Ethics Committee deadlocked on whether to release a report about child sex trafficking and illicit drug use allegations against former Congressman Matt Gaetz, the Florida Republican, who is Donald Trump's choice for U.S. Attorney General, setting up a possible constitutional clash between the House and the Senate. As the New York Times reports it, senators in both parties have clamored to see the bipartisan conclusions of the House panel's years-long investigation into Gaetz's conduct as part of their constitutional duty to advise and consent regarding presidential nominees who normally require Senate confirmation. Though I don't know if I actually see senators clamoring for the release of that report. Maybe I'm missing it. Have you seen any?
I have seen clamoring? No clamoring. None.
Some Democrats have asked pretty nicely for that, and a few Republicans have suggested that they might maybe want to see it before agreeing to confirm Gaetz's nomination to become the nation's top law enforcement officer. But since Trump named Mr. Gaetz last week as his choice to head the Justice Department, House Republicans have been reluctant, which is also putting it nicely, New York Times, reluctant to make the report public. Following an hours-long meeting of the secretive ethics panel on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, Representative Michael Guest, the Mississippi Republican who chairs that committee, emerged to say only, quote, "There was no agreement by the committee to release the report." He declined to comment further, as did other members of the panel, which includes five Republicans and five Democrats. But to my reading, and I admit my sources are not as good as the New York Times sources on Capitol Hill, but if there was no agreement to release it, that would seem to mean that, all five of the Republicans on the panel voted against releasing it. The self-proclaimed very, very Christian GOP House Speaker, and we know he's very, very Christian because he's told us so himself, Mike Johnson, pressured the committee last week to not release its findings on Gaetz and his alleged pedophilia and the $10,000 that he reportedly paid for sex, arguing that it would constitute a, quote, "terrible breach of protocol," unquote, to do so after a member had resigned from office. Now, as we all know, breaching protocol is far, far worse than paying for sex and drugs with minors, especially when it's done by the man nominated to become the nation's top cop, don't you think? In the Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike have demanded, says the Times, demanded to see the report as part of the confirmation process. But have they? Some Republican lawmakers, like Senator John Cornyn of Texas, have very, very politely suggested that the Senate Judiciary Committee, which has jurisdiction over Justice Department nominees, could subpoena the House committee if it did not willingly hand over the file. They could. I guess that's what counts for demanding. From the New York Times. In addition to his ethical and legal challenges, Mr. Gaetz has a long record of gleefully disparaging some Republican senators whose votes he now needs to be confirmed. For instance, he's referred to outgoing Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell as Mitch McFailure. Good one, Matt. But on Wednesday, Matt Gaetz was working to shore up his support with Republican skeptics in the Senate, including Cornyn and Senator Susan Collins of Maine. We will see if the retiring Senator McFailure votes for Gaetz anyway for his confirmation, just as he repeatedly let Donald Trump off the hook for his crimes. And, of course, I'm sure Susan Collins is very concerned about these allegations of sexual misdeeds. Just ask lifetime appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court and accused sexual assaulter, Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Yes, she will furrow her brow as she votes to confirm him.
Since the spring of 2021, the ethics panel has been investigating Gates over an array of allegations, including that he engaged in sexual misconduct and illicit drug use. He shared inappropriate images or videos on the House floor. He misused state identification records. He converted campaign funds to personal use and accepted gifts that violate House rules. That's a list of things that the New York Times has kind of softened throughout all of their descriptions of what he is accused of doing. But, of course, that's what the New York Times does, and that's why, well, one of the big reasons that we're in the mess that we're in right now. All of that, of course, no matter how you describe it, sounds perfect for the role of U.S. Attorney General. We will also try to get Eliason's thoughts on this matter as well from a guy who has spent years at the Justice Department. Which is soon to be presided over by Matt Gaetz, at least if Trump has his way, which he usually does. In other ridiculous clown show nomination news by Chief Clown and the gravest domestic threat to ever face this nation, since we last spoke, Donald Trump has named former WWE pro wrestling co-founder Linda McMahon to be Secretary of the Department of Education, despite Trump's vows to shut the entire department down. And he's tapped TV doctor and snake oil salesman Dr. Mehmet Oz to lead the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. But before we get to Randall today, a quick word or two on a Trump nominee that has garnered much less attention, perhaps because the guy doesn't have a TV show on Fox yet. But remember how pretend furious and pretend indignant that Donald Trump was during the campaign whenever the Harris campaign or the media cited the Heritage Foundation's 900-page Project 2025 blueprint for his presidency if he were to win office, and how Trump said that he had nothing to do with this manifesto and he wanted nothing to do with anyone who was involved in the project, even though it was written by a whole bunch of folks who served in his previous administration. Well, I hope you're sitting down, because it turns out Donald Trump may have been lying about that, Desi Doyen. According to longtime media critic Brian Stelter this week, Trump's pick for chair of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, over the weekend, Brendan Carr, wasted no time in stating his priorities on Sunday night, just hours after receiving the nomination, just an hour after thanking the president for the future president for the appointment. Carr wrote on Twitter, quote, "We must dismantle the censorship cartel and restore free speech rights for everyday Americans." Who knew they had been taken away? Did you know? The comments from Carr, who wrote the chapter on the FCC in, wait for it, Project 2025, signaled that it will not be business as usual at the country's communications regulatory agency. Past chairs of the agency, notes Stelter, both Republican and Democratic, have, you know, looked at things like broadband internet deployment and wireless spectrum policy. Carr did not mention any of those issues, however, on Sunday night. Instead, he took aim at technology companies for, quote, censorship, which, by the way, private companies are welcome to do if they wish. The First Amendment does not apply to them. It only applies to the government. Carr promised to hold broadcast TV and radio stations accountable. For what? Well, who knows? And he pledged to end the FCC's promotion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, because we would hate to have diversity or equity or inclusion over our public airwaves. Trump previously appointed Carr to the FCC back in 2017. He's currently the senior Republican at that agency. He's also got close ties with Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, the owner of Twitter, now X, and the guy who spent some $200 million to elect Donald Trump in the first place. Musk has also, of course, been tapped to head something that he and Trump are calling the Department of Government Efficiency, which is a department that doesn't actually exist. Carr has accused Democrats of waging, quote, regulatory lawfare against Elon Musk and his Starlink satellite internet service. As chair of the FCC, Carr may now be able to steer enormous federal subsidies to Elon Musk's Starlink. When Politico published a story titled "The DC Bureaucrat Who Could Deliver Billions to Elon Musk" last month, Carr told the outlet he'd be an even-handed regulator if he was tapped to head the FCC, and I'm sure he will. In his Project 2025 chapter, Carr laid out an agenda for the federal agency under a future Trump administration, saying that, though he vows to be a warrior for free speech, his chapter in Project 2025 calls for TikTok to be banned immediately. How's that for free speech? He's also supported the rollback of net neutrality rules that otherwise help ensure free speech over the internet. And he called for, quote, legislation that scraps Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives immunity to tech platforms that moderate user-generated content so that tech platforms will be, if that is scrapped, encouraged to actually block free speech that they would become legally accountable for. The FCC already has jurisdiction over local TV and radio licenses. During his reelection campaign, Trump called for every major American TV network to be punished. What a champion of free speech, often because of interview questions or programming that he didn't like. He repeatedly said that certain licenses should be revoked from those TV news networks. The FCC grants 8-year license terms and hasn't actually denied any license renewal in decades, but Carr indicated this month that he would take Trump's complaints very seriously, and he seemed to repeat as much on Fox News on Tuesday.
You know, there's a lot the FCC can do. Broadcasters are differently situated than other speakers. They get free access to a valuable public resource, the airwaves, and they're licensed by the FCC, and the exchange for that is they have to serve the public interest. I think it's important that we take another look at that and we reinvigorate it.
Yeah, reinvigorate it. He's right. Broadcast licenses exist in exchange for serving the public interest. But what does that public interest mean? Well, that will now be decided by the Republican and Trump appointees who will hold the majority on the FCC. As we told you previously, Project 2025 cites the Pacifica Radio Network specifically by name as one of the public broadcasting outlets that should be targeted and or punished in a Trump regime. Many Pacifica affiliate stations carry the broadcast right now, including KPFK, our flagship station here in L.A., which is a wholly owned Pacifica radio station. So do you suppose the FCC will find reason to decide that, well, maybe I am not speaking in the public interest over our public airwaves? We'll see. They're not in control yet, so at least until then, we will keep reporting on what we believe is in the public interest, including criminal accountability for a criminal once and apparently future President of the United States. We'll discuss all of that and more with former federal prosecutor Randall Eliason after a quick break on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Just become president and you don't pay any price at all. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As our friend and former longtime federal prosecutor Randall D. Eliason writes this week at The Atlantic, one of the many troubling consequences of Donald Trump's re-election is that he will largely avoid responsibility for his conduct in his four criminal cases. No other criminal defendant in American history has had the power to shut down his own prosecution. This is unprecedented and a wrenching affront to the principle that no one is above the law. He is, of course, referring to Trump's four still existing criminal indictments, still existing for now, two at the federal level, including one related to his multiple failed attempts to steal the 2020 election, and the other related to his alleged theft of thousands of pages of highly classified national security documents upon leaving office the last time and refusing to give them back to the government. And two at the state level, one in Georgia for a broad conspiracy to try and steal that state's 2020 election, in which he is criminally indicted for racketeering with 18 co-conspirators, and the other in New York State, which Eliason notes is the one exception, at least to date, in Trump's efforts so far to avoid accountability for allegedly years of criminal conduct. The potential exception is the New York State case, writes Eliason. In May, a jury found Trump guilty of 34 counts, felony counts, related to falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to the adult film star Stormy Daniels prior to the 2016 election. The judge in the case, Justice Juan Merchan, recently granted the party's joint request to pause the New York proceeding while both sides consider what should be done in light of Trump's re-election. Trump's attorneys claim that the case must be dismissed altogether to avoid, quote, unconstitutional impediments to President Trump's ability to govern, unquote. That after, out of an abundance of caution, Merchan avoided a pre-election sentencing in that case that potentially could have influenced the election, but Eliason argues the election result changes nothing about the criminal case. Now that the election is over, sentencing, still for the moment anyway, scheduled for November 26, should proceed promptly, with Eliason going on to explain why, which we will discuss with him momentarily. In the meantime, in a letter to Justice Merchan on Tuesday, prosecutors from Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg's office made clear to the judge that they want to see Donald Trump sentenced over the hush money scheme, even if that means waiting until he leaves the White House. But in their letter, prosecutors admitted that though they will oppose Trump's request to dismiss the case entirely on grounds of so-called presidential immunity, a concept largely dreamt up by Donald Trump in the defenses of his various federal cases and drafted into actual reality out of virtually thin air by the far-right activist Republican U.S. Supreme Court majority this past summer, he admits that we are all deep in uncharted legal territory at this point. After a New York jury found Trump guilty before his re-election, creating an unprecedented circumstance for prosecutors and, of course, the nation. Speaking for the people of New York, who the prosecutors represent, they write, quote, "The people deeply respect the office of the president, are mindful of the demands and obligations of the presidency, and acknowledge that defendant's inauguration will raise unprecedented legal questions." Prosecutors added pointedly, however, that they also, quote, "deeply respect the fundamental role of the jury in our constitutional system." Judge Merchan now faces two unresolved requests from Trump to dismiss the case entirely, one filed before the election, asserting that the Supreme Court's July immunity ruling essentially trumps, pun intended, the jury verdict, and then a second request from arguing that Trump's victory in the November election should force a complete dismissal of the case. Merchan has yet to rule on either of those requests, and though the DA's office indicated in the letter that they would oppose them, they agreed to pause Trump's sentencing, which, as noted, is still on the schedule for November 26, as I understand it, pending resolution of all of these unprecedented questions. Trump spokesman Stephen Chung, who is set to become the new Trump administration's White House communication director, portrayed Bragg's agreement to pause deadlines for now in the case as a, quote, total and definitive victory, which it isn't, at least not as of right now. Or is it? Joining us now to help us untangle this confusing and unprecedented mess and to touch on another point or two regarding our newly bizarre system of justice, not to mention the Federal Department of Justice itself under the incoming Trump administration, is our longtime friend Randall D. Eliason, the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School, contributes his wisdom to a whole bunch of mainstream outlets, even while blogging at his own Substack site newsletter called sidebarsblog.com. Randall Eliason, sir, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is obviously quite a mess, and I'm wondering how the Manhattan DA's letter on Tuesday changes, if at all, your very strong argument made over the weekend for the need for the judge to, in the New York case, to sentence Trump immediately. But before we get to that, Randall, if you don't mind, I need to get some of your thoughts on the announced decision to appoint now resigned Florida Rep. Matt Gaetz as the nation's next U.S. Attorney General, the nation's top law enforcement official. Got some specific questions on that, but let me get your general thoughts at this point, whatever they may be.
Well, it's extremely concerning. I mean, on paper, on his face, obviously he's completely unqualified for the job. He's got no experience within the Justice Department, no prosecutorial experience, minimal experience as any kind of attorney at all. And his only reconnection to the Justice Department, as far as I can tell, has been as the subject of a criminal investigation, not ever working at DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, I mean, the complete lack of relevant qualifications. I mean, the biggest concern, of course, is that Trump has repeatedly threatened, vowed to use the justice system to go after political enemies, which is what authoritarian regimes do, not the United States. But Gaetz's main qualification for the position seems to be a willingness to probably go along with that and help Trump, you know, carry out sort of his worst instincts on how to use the Justice Department as a personal political weapon. So I think it's extremely concerning appointment, and I'm actually somewhat confident that even this will be too much even for the Senate Republicans, and that he won't actually end up being confirmed.
I don't know if you're still in touch with those folks who are still at the DOJ after your long time there, but I'm wondering what, if anything, you're hearing from folks who are still there or other former colleagues about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty universally shared view. It's it doesn't really depend on politics. I mean, people in that institution who have worked at that institution love it, feel strongly about kind of the principles it stands for. And, you know, it's easy for those to sound idealistic or naive sometimes, but they're really fundamental to the people that work there and believe in it. The idea of the rule of law and politics don't enter into prosecution decisions. And, you know, just the idea that appears to be nothing to the president-elect, and the damage that could be done to the institution and individuals, you know, through this kind of appointment is just, I think, troubling to almost anybody who sort of cares deeply about the Justice Department and the work that it does.
I think a lot of us are sort of shaking our heads as details continue to come out about these accusations against Gaetz, paid sex with, and the trafficking of minors. There's a report from Washington Post today that he apparently paid two girls, some $10,000 for this illicit drug use, all with, you know, apparently many witnesses to these acts. And yet, Randall, after full investigation at the DOJ, declined to actually charge him for any of this. He claims the DOJ has cleared him of all charges. I don't think that's quite right. Can you give us an idea of under what sort of legit conditions the DOJ might decline to bring charges in a case like this that seems so cut and dry from the outside based on the reported testimony from seemingly so many witnesses?
Well, we really have to, I think, be careful about drawing conclusions about how strong a case is based on press reports. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors, of course, have to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury before they consider bringing it. And so that's always a decision that's part of the job, is to make that decision, whether the evidence that you've got is enough to, you know, make it over that hurdle. And it's impossible to tell from the outside what went into that decision, whether they thought it was, you know, witness credibility issues or other evidentiary issues or lack of relevant federal statutory crimes at issue. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. A lot of sex crimes actually, you know, state jurisdiction, not federal. Mm-hmm. But okay. It's certainly not an exoneration. I mean, going around saying you're clear, that's not what it means. It means they close the investigation without choosing to bring a criminal case. That says nothing about, you know, whether the conduct actually happened. It's just a judgment about whether those facts give rise to a federal criminal prosecution that you think you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think, you know, those allegations should be disqualifying, and in any normal world would be, but that's not even really the most serious thing. I mean, it's like, you know, even just take those away, it's just the complete lack of qualifications and then the fear about what he would do in that position as President Trump's underling, you know? Uh-huh. So, I mean, whether or not those allegations were out there, this is still an incredibly troubling appointment.
And there's another aspect to this that we discussed on yesterday's program with former DOJ Deputy Attorney General Lisa Graves. Actually, not yesterday, earlier this week, about the Trump transition team's refusal to sign mandated agreements with the White House and the General Services Administration, et cetera, and how that means that the FBI is apparently not, at least currently, vetting Trump's nominees to top posts or any posts, apparently, as of now. And Lisa Graves, was very alarmed by the potential security threat of cutting the FBI out of this process and the possibility that compromised individuals could take control of key government agencies in the next Trump administration. We had a report this week that some of the Matt Gaetz files were actually hacked by someone unknown. What are your thoughts on that aspect of this?
No, she's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, law that mandates that the FBI does the background investigations, but it's certainly the convention for good reason. But we know, you know, that Trump has shown in the past little regard for kinds of norms and conventions and the way Washington usually works. So, you know, the only thing that can be done is if the Senate has enough of a backbone to sort of insist on it and to say, look, we can't confirm nominees to these incredibly important positions, including national security positions and things like that, without a real background check by the FBI. And, you know, that's kind of the only check on it at this point. If the Senate is okay to roll over and go along with this, then I don't think there's anything that can be done. But it is remarkably concerning. Yeah.
Can the Senate, by the way, and I don't know if you know this or not, because it's a sort of perhaps a Senate issue, but if the U.S. House Ethics Committee declines to release their own reportedly completed report on all of this, can the U.S. Senate actually subpoena the DOJ for documents on its investigation into these same allegations?
Well, those are always pretty complicated fights, you know, because DOJ protects criminal investigation records pretty closely and for a lot of good reasons. You know, they include grand jury material that's typically not subject to release and information that affects the privacy of individuals who are under investigation or who are witnesses. So, I mean, they could issue a subpoena, whether it would ever be in force or successful and certainly in time to, you know, do us any good at this point. Is a much tougher question. I think they can demand the House report, though. I mean, you know, again, from their fellow legislative chamber, right? Mm-hmm. Say, we're not going to vote on this confirmation until we've got the House report. Even if you don't make it public, the senators need to be able to see it before they can decide on their vote. You
know? Right. Of course, that would ultimately depend on a Republican majority once they take over that majority after the first of the year. A Republican majority demanding that of the U.S. House, their colleagues there.
Yeah, no, it's a big unknown. And the whole recess appointment thing, too. I mean, a lot of this now is going to, how much Trump can get away with is going to come down to whether the Senate Republicans have any backbone at all. and are willing to stand up for their constitutional role in advice and consent, and you know, or are they just going to roll over for Trump and let him do whatever he wants? And, you know, that's going to be a pretty early sign of what the next 4 years are going to be like if they just agree to all this and say, okay, you know, we don't really care.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I do want to get on to the New York hush money business. But since you raised this point about these recess appointments, it seems to me, Randall Eliason, there is no question that Donald Trump is going to invoke this provision from the Constitution that has never been used before, certainly not in this way, to essentially say that the president of the United States has the right to adjourn Congress, to adjourn the Senate. And in that adjournment, recess appoint pretty much any and all of these nominees, no matter who they are, no matter how controversial they are. Is that how you see this? Because I don't see why he wouldn't do that at this point.
Yeah, I've read some about that. I'm not an expert on how that is supposedly would work. You know, I assume it's never been done before, and I assume it might lead to some kind of litigation challenges to the nominee's authority from someone who's injured by one of these appointees who gets put in, but you know, that could take a long time to resolve. But yeah, will he try, especially if he's got Mike Johnson willing to go along with it? I don't see any reason why he wouldn't, right?
Yeah.
I think he seems to feel like now there's not much of anything standing in his way for doing anything he wants. And you know, unless and until someone shows him otherwise, he's just gonna plow ahead.
Yeah, he feels that way. Because there really is nothing keeping him from doing whatever it is he wants, especially with that ruling over the weekend, over the summer from the U.S. Supreme Court saying presidents are, in fact, above the law, can pretty much carry out any crime they wish without the possibility of any sort of accountability. Meantime, there has been an attempt, at least, at accountability, most successfully seen so far in New York. So Randall Eliason with Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg largely conceding this week that sentencing can be at least delayed for now, while opposing the request by Trump to dismiss the 34 criminal convictions brought by a jury against him, to dismiss that entirely in the hush money verdict. This is all as confusing, I think, as it is unprecedented. He's against the case being thrown out entirely, the prosecutor. He recognizes the unprecedented nature of all of this, but he believes the sentencing should still move forward, at least at some point, so the case should not be dismissed. First, am I reading the DA's argument correctly, as confusing as it is? And then we'll get to your argument.
Yes, I think so. I mean, there was a lot of reporting yesterday that the DA had agreed to put off sentencing until 2029. I don't read his letter that way. He agreed that it could be postponed for now until pending motions to dismiss are resolved.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think and he mentioned that could include the possibility of postponing it until after Trump's out of office. But he didn't commit to that or suggest that was the only possible solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the reasonable solution would be to let them go ahead and litigate the motions to dismiss in the next few weeks. If Judge Mershon denies them, then to go ahead to the sentencing before January 20th. And at that point, the appeals can proceed while he's in office. That requires minimal amount of the president's time. And I mean, his lawyers are arguing this immunity applies not only to the president, but the president-elect, because it will dramatically interfere with his transition duties and things like that. But look, showing up in a New York courtroom for a couple hours is not going to substantially interfere with his transition. And the sentence itself can be suspended, or maybe it's just a fine. You know, I mean, at this point, it's almost less important what the actual sentence is, because he's not going to be sent to jail, clearly, at least before 2029.
Right.
But I think it's important for the justice system to see that this case gets concluded and doesn't just kind of dangle out there for the next 3-4 years. And if you look at the reasons for immunity, according to the Supreme Court, it's primarily to avoid the president being deterred from acting, you know, boldly as the president, because he's fear he might be prosecuted in the future. And it's to avoid taking up a bunch of the president's time while he's the president. Well, neither one of those applies to a case that's already been tried and we already have a jury verdict, and it could be sentenced before he even takes office. That's not going to chill him from doing anything as president, because it's over. And it's not going to take any of his time because appeals are handled by the lawyers. It requires almost no time of the client at all. He doesn't even have to go to the courtroom for the argument.
So let me be clear about that, because you say it would only require a few hours. Presumably that's for the sentencing, that he would need to be there during the actual pronouncement of the sentence by the judge if that moves forward. So there would be some of that time. Again, that could happen before he is sworn in as president. And then thereafter, because he can't actually officially appeal this case until the sentencing actually happens, and then he can move forward with the appeal. But you're saying he doesn't need to be in court for that. That can all be handled by his attorneys, right?
For the appeals, yes.
For the appeal.
I mean, they'd have to probably, they have to consult with him a little bit about the briefs probably, but it's pretty minimal. His attorneys are just assuming that this immunity doctrine applies to appellate proceedings, that it applies to a case that's already been tried and concluded before you were president. I mean, none of that is clear. And they're just sort of, they're taking the broadest possible reading of the immunity decision, you know, as possible, which is understandable, but they assert all these things as if they're facts. And we don't have any precedent for any of this.
And they're assuming that it applies.
Would be reason. Yeah.
They're assuming that it applies to state cases at all, right? Because the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling here has to do with federal cases, doesn't have anything to do really with state cases like the New York case or the Georgia case, does it?
Well, it's constitutional immunity, so I don't think a state would be allowed to prosecute a president for official executive acts after the immunity decision either.
But of course, paying off a porn star prior to his even winning election back in 2016 is not in any way an official act.
Exactly. But I mean, if a state were to try to prosecute the president for ordering a drone strike or something, the state says a homicide. I mean, the immunity doctrine is going to say the state can't do that either.
Right.
It's not going to be limited to the feds. Yeah.
You posted this on Blue Sky yesterday, quote, if you want to ensure Trump tries to run again in 2028, keep alive the prospect that he might be sent to jail after he leaves office. Delaying sentencing until 2029 is a bad idea, you write. Better to impose a sentence now that won't interfere with his presidential duty. So if I'm understanding your argument there, it sounds like the back and forth in New York on Monday has not changed your argument that Trump should be sentenced now before he takes office. But can he be sentenced to jail? You say it's unlikely, but can he be sentenced to jail in a deferred sentence to take place on, noon on January 21 of 2029?
Well, I think theoretically, yes. I don't think the judge could specify the exact date and time, but you could.
Until he is no longer the president.
Until he's no longer in office.
Right.
But then you'd have to give him some reasonable amount of time to, move out of the White House, I suppose, but
right.
not 1201 on inauguration day.
Okay.
But I think that's a theoretical possibility. I mean, I guess it seems very unlikely to me at this point that the judge wants to do that and have a prison sentence hanging over his head for 4 years. But theoretically, yeah.
What other sentence would be the possibilities, the menu of choices here
fines,
for sentencing?
Yeah, fines and probation. And probation would also have to be suspended, I think. And then probation can have different levels of supervision, how intensive it has to be or not. It could be, again, it's hard to see a former president having to report to a probation officer once a month at age 83 or whatever, but. Yeah, so that's why I said in my piece in The Atlantic, it's almost more important now just that a sentencing happens. At this point, he's dodged all four bullets, right? He's going to basically get away with all of this. And even in the New York case, the sentencing at this point can't be that meaningful or consequential. But I think it should take place just as a matter of the justice system, completing this prosecution, honoring the jury's verdict, and having an official judgment of conviction entered on the record that he is, in fact, a convicted felon. And then the appeals can proceed in the normal course, but there's no reason, there's no question Mershon could have sentenced Trump before the election, right? I mean, the sentencing was set for September, I think.
Right.
And there's no doubt he could have sentenced him then, and he chose not to as a matter of his discretion out of an abundance of caution because he didn't want it to look political, like he was trying to influence the election. Well, it'd be kind of absurd now if he did that and then the outcome is, oh, now I can't sentence him at all. I mean, he clearly had the power to do it before the election. I don't think the election changes anything in that regard.
And I would like to think he thought that through. Merchan has been very smart on, you know, in this entire case, very reasonable. It seems to me that he would have thought that through.
And he hasn't tipped his hand yet in terms of how he wants to proceed.
And by the way,
he's got letters from both sides, but we haven't heard from him yet.
And do you know when we're expecting to hear from him on that? Because as I understand, sentencing is still scheduled for November 26th.
I think it's technically still on the calendar, but it's not going to happen on the both sides basically have agreed it should not happen on the 26th. I think the only and both sides have agreed that Trump should file his motions to dismiss, which includes now a motion to dismiss based on the election results, which, again, I don't know, this argument. The people have spoken, you know, an overwhelming victory, and that means the jury verdict no longer counts.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys went to law school. That's not how jury verdicts work.
they don't care.
Popular vote.
They don't care. They're creating the laws. They go, and apparently they can even, you know, rewrite the Constitution. I've been struck for the past week or two. We came across John Roberts' 2005 Senate confirmation hearings. And I don't know if you've heard this, but I just want to kind of play this because now Chief Justice Roberts is the one who made this ruling that presidents are, in fact, above the law. They can't be criminal charges can't be brought against them for official acts they perform while in office. Yet here was then Judge Roberts during his 2005 Senate confirmation hearing.
I believe that no one is above the law under our system, and that includes the president. The president is fully bound by the law, the Constitution, and statutes.
I'm reading that correctly, that his ruling in Trump v. U.S. over the summer is the complete opposite of what he just stated in 2005 in his Senate confirmation hearings, correct?
Yeah, sure sounds like it.
Yeah. Very quickly, Randall Eliason, the case in Georgia, that is still on the books. It is the Georgia Appeals Court on Tuesday canceled, I think without comment, an argument over Trump's efforts to disqualify the Fulton County DA, Fonnie Willis, from that case regarding his attempt to steal the 2020 election in the state against him and 18 co-defendants. I don't know if any of us have any insight into what is going on there. But even if Trump is, if Willis is allowed to stay on the case or someone else is assigned to it, if the case moves forward and somehow Donald Trump is off the hook because he's the president now, is there anything that stops the case against his 18 co-defendants, including folks like Rudy Giuliani, his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, et cetera, from moving forward, even if the alleged mastermind in this broad racketeering conspiracy is released from the case?
No, I don't think so. I mean, and that's one very remotely hopeful prospect still, I guess, is that if the prosecutors survive all these various appeals, like you said, Trump will almost certainly be, at least the case against him would be paused until he was out of office. But I don't see a reason that the case against everyone else couldn't go forward, and that would include potentially a very public trial, again revealing all these allegations one more time about what happened in the 2020 mm-hmm. election, mm-hmm. And like you said, against some very high profile people like Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows, you know, other people that were very close to the Trump. So, you know, that could still be pretty interesting.
Yes.
I think it's a pretty big case. It's pretty unwieldy with, you know, 14 defendants remaining or something. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't expect that to happen quickly. And then, like you said, we don't know. The Georgia Court of Appeals dropped this oral argument and didn't explain why. So we don't know what's going on there either. So,
but you suggest that there is it can legally occur that they would say, okay, the co-defendants, co-conspirators, you guys can go to trial right now. He will be held until he is out of office, or a trial against him will be deferred until he is out of office. That's a possibility as well?
Yes, Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they call it severing a defendant. You know, you'd sever Trump out and put that case in abeyance. I mean, Trump can't order it dismissed the way he can with the federal prosecutions.
Right.
I'm sure the lawyers would try to come up with some legal arguments that, based on immunity or something else, that it needs to be dismissed completely. But you could sort of deal with that, and there's nothing about the case against the remaining defendants that I can see that would say it can't go forward. Now, someone like Meadows, I mean, they might still try to, they might try to argue that presidential immunity applies to them because they're acting on his behalf, and we'd have to see how that shakes out. I don't think that's clear from the Supreme Court's decision, how much it extends to the president's staff. And so that could end up being an issue as well. But yeah, there's definitely the, in terms of just legal possibilities, yes, you can sever Trump out and you can try everybody else.
As far as putting a punctuation mark on all of this, and your argument that in New York, justice sort of demands that sentencing occurs so we can, you know, finish this case in one sense, say, you know, that, that justice has been done. When it comes to the federal cases, apparently Trump, even though it also has not been ever done, but I guess, you know, he can come to, once he comes into office, he can just order the DOJ to make these cases go away. How should, in the interest of justice, how would you like to see Special Counsel Jack Smith proceed in those two cases? Would you like to see him wrap up these cases before Trump takes office? How would you like to see that come to the apparent end that it will be coming to?
Well, part of me feels like, I mean, Special Counsel's offices can continue cross administrations, right? I mean, they don't necessarily get dissolved when the administration leaves office.
They didn't and in the weaponized investigation of Hunter Biden from, you know, from the Trump administration into Biden.
So part of me would like to see them stay and keep working and make Trump fire them, you know, sort of make him take the political heat for actually shutting down the cases himself. It doesn't sound like that's the way they're going to go. It's the, all the reports are that DOJ is talking about ways to wrap it up and Smith's going to resign before Trump's inaugurated. And given, I mean, one benefit to that approach may be if the investigation is officially shut down, Smith can write a report. And for Garland, he's required to write a report for Garland,
right?
Just like the Mueller report, right? And then Garland can choose to make that public. So if all that gets done before January 20th, then that eliminates the ability of the incoming administration to sort of bury whatever Jack Smith found. I don't know how much there is that we don't already know, because there's been so much reporting and other cases and things about these allegations already in the January, the House Committee report, things like that. But, you know, it would be nice to see Smith's report and to see that done before he leaves. So at least there's a historical record of what he found before they were forced to close up shop.
Yeah, I think, though not particularly satisfying, that still kind of feels like the most satisfying ending to that particular story. Are any of the civil cases, by the way, Randall, the $350 million fraud verdict or so, as I recall, in New York under Attorney General Tish James, the $90 million jury verdict against Trump for sexual assault that was won by E. Jean Carroll, are any of those affected by his election as president? Those move forward as they are now?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, the Supreme Court established under the Clinton administration that a civil lawsuit can go forward, especially if it involves conduct that took place when you weren't president. You know, so I don't think those civil judgments should be affected. I mean, they'll continue to be litigated on, they're all being appealed on various grounds, but I don't think the fact that he was elected or the presidential immunity decision should have any impact on those civil judgments.
Well, thank you for all that cheery news, Randall Eliason. You can find his work as ever at sidebarsblog.com. I will link to his piece at The Atlantic on why Trump's New York sentencing must proceed over at The Atlantic. And you can now find him over at Blue Sky, where you can also now find me as well, by the way. He is, as he was over at Twitter, available at RD Eliason over at the social media site Blue Sky. Randall, really appreciate you joining us here. We may have to turn to your expertise more and more in the frustrating years that lie ahead, but really grateful you have time to join us today.
Thanks. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You know, it did not occur to me that...
Grim, huh?
Yes.
Depressing. Sad.
Yes.
You're sorry you sat in for this interview today, aren't you? Sorry.
Well, I just want to say it did not occur to me that if the sentencing in the New York case does not go forward, that Trump might actually use that as a reason to run for a third term so he can continue to escape accountability.
Yeah.
I mean, that just... Oh, my God.
Well, of course, he will use anything he can.
True.
It doesn't need to happen for him to try to make that case.
True.
The Constitution, by the way, just before anybody panics, the Constitution clearly says you cannot run for more than two terms in office. But of course, this is Donald Trump. As you know, he's been able to rewrite the Constitution itself to find that presidents are above the law. After all, who knew?
So,
don't put anything past him.
Yeah.
And of course, the argument that's being floated is, well, the Constitution, the amendment on this, what is it, the 23rd Amendment, I think, is unclear. It says two terms, but do those two terms have to be in a row? So he hasn't run two consecutive terms. Would that allow him to run for a third term? You know what? Let's not even go there yet, because we got a long time till we get there. And in the meantime... He's got a lot of shooting his own self in the foot to happen between now and then.
I don't
suspect this administration is going to go well. I think people are going to be reminded of why they booted him in the first place once he takes office, and the way things are going with the appointments and so forth. I think they're noticing in advance why he was run out of office in the first place.
We shall see.
So we shall see. Yes, we shall.
Yeah.
All right. Oof. We have got to get out. My thanks again to Randall Eliason of George Washington University Law School, to my producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other that we have ever done, or you want to hear it again or share it with friends, family, and neighbors and enemies and everyone else, you can do that for free at bradblog.com. You can always download it there. That is thanks to those of you who help us stay on your public airwaves until the FCC decides otherwise by hitting a donate button or going straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, yes, now including Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, America.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.